This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and at the controls is Jason Croft. Technology has given us today access to just a staggering amount of information. It is possible now to have access to some of the world's greatest libraries, have that access be electronic, have that virtually any hour of the day or night, and from just about anywhere in the world. However, there are still some limitations that can exclude many people, and it does raise questions about the sort of promises that have been made about the information society and how much information will be available and to whom and in what sort of a way. And that's the question that we will be discussing here this morning in this part of the show. And our guest for the program is Alex Byrne. He is here visiting the campus from Australia. He's here to give the 16th annual Mortenson Distinguished Lecture. His visit here is sponsored by the Mortenson Center for International Library Programs, which periodically throughout the year has events. They have this lecture series, and then people who work in the library field various places around the world come to the university to study what are the most contemporary sort of methods for managing libraries and information. He'll be giving a talk this afternoon on the topic, can international organizations deliver the information society? He is, among other things here, the president of the International Federation of Library Associations, which is the leading international body for people who are in the library and information science profession. He is, in addition, pro-vice chancellor and vice president of teaching and learning and vice president of alumni and development at the University of Technology in Sydney, and here spending a little time on the campus, and we're pleased that he could be here with us to talk. Questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Morning, David. Thanks for having me.
Just for a moment, I guess it's to make sure that people know what we're talking about when we talk about the benefits of the information society. Now, with the internet, I guess the idea is that it provides unprecedented kind of access to a variety of kinds of information, provided, of course, that you have the computer and you know how to use it and you can read the language the stuff is in. You know, there are a number of sort of qualifications. But I guess if you ask the question, look at the promises that were made and look at where we are now, how close are we coming, do you think, to fulfilling the promise of this kind of access to information?
I think there's been remarkable, extraordinary achievement, especially since the invention of the World Wide Web, which provides such an easy, almost intuitive means of access. But there's still a long way to go. There's some 60% of the people in the world who don't have access to the internet. And then, as you pointed out, even if the internet is theoretically available, you may not have the equipment or you may not be able to afford the software. And there's a really big question of content. The content may not be relevant. It may not be in languages you understand. It may not be culturally acceptably phrased or presented, and of course you may lack the skills, the information literacy to really understand and evaluate the content.
Mm. Well, if you look at all of those things, do you think this primarily is it primarily an infrastructure issue? Is it primarily an educational issue, or is it mostly a resource issue? And when it comes to the individuals having or lacking the basic tools to be able to access all this information?
Well, it's of course all of those things. The infrastructure issue is in some ways relatively simple, because with satellites, with undersea cables, we can put the internet virtually anywhere in the world. The boxes and wires, given enough money, are pretty easy to deliver. But will they be used? No, they won't be used if they don't seem relevant. And one of the great stories that I've come across comes from Chile, where the Robinson Crusoe Islands, just off the coast of Chile, which were named because that's where Alexander Selkirk was marooned and led to the story of Robinson Crusoe. They're very isolated. They were connected to the internet through the public library service, and a grandfather now uses the public library every week because he can go in there and on the internet hook up and see his grandchildren in the far north of Chile who he'd never met or seen before. So at a human level, he has a reason to do it. Mm-hmm. And we all need that reason, whether it's a human thing like that or something to do with business or education, agriculture, and so on.
Yeah. Well, and that suggests that libraries have a very important role to play here as providers, as a way of access. And I'm sure that the issues, depending on what kind of library you are, the issues are a little bit different. Whether you are you have a major research library like yours or like ours, or you have a community library, a community public library, people are going to want different sorts of things. But I suppose the thing that both those kinds of libraries share is that in increased demand for services, that really doesn't change with either the big library or the small library.
That's true. Libraries provide a key enabling locus, an interface in which people can use all sorts of information resources, of course, the traditional ones in print, even going back to clay tablets for the scholars, as well as the internet. And in the library, they've got a safe space where they're physically safe, but they're also safe from abuse or any other interference, where there's assistance available and where people can help them negotiate what is it that they're looking for, how might they find it, and when they've found it, is it reliable? And that's, of course, a really big question on the internet, mm-hmm. because it's such a wealth of information, from the very good to the downright mendacious.
Yeah. Well, for you have been working in the library field for some time now. How, over that time, has what people want, what they're looking for you to help them do, has that really changed very much?
Yes, I think it has changed. I think we've really moved into an information society, mm-hmm. and it's always been true that we've needed information. The foundation of this great university was around knowing more about supporting agriculture and the agriculture extension services. And the same was true in my country, in Australia, that we needed to help people settle the land and spread out, create industry, and so on. That's true. But now we're assailed by information of all sorts at all times, and the big need now is to be able to discriminate information. A lot of the old jobs have disappeared. The more manual jobs have largely disappeared, even in the agricultural sector, where the productivity per farmer has gone up enormously, and that's all information and information society. So we've seen that change. We've also seen education expand from the majority of the population getting only elementary education to now, in developed countries, almost all young people completing their 12 years of schooling or close to that, and a very significant proportion going on to tertiary study.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not that I'm all that old, but certainly I'm old enough to remember card catalogs, and the process of say you were just going to the library and you were going to look for something that you want to search the collection, you want to find out what was there, that you could physically go there and actually flip. You know, there was a little drawer you pulled out and it had these cards, and you flip through every one. And it's what was interesting is that what that did was it gave you a kind of sense of what was there. Sometimes you found things that you actually weren't looking for that were kind of interesting. And the problem I know that a lot of people point to about today's databases is it's not the searching process is not quite the same. Someone is coming in between you and the listings of things, and it was making some sort of preliminary selection. So you're really not actually looking at everything there is. You're looking at what somebody has decided you're going to look at. And now I think there's a lot of controversy and debate and concern about who it is that's doing this vetting and what sort of considerations there are, and are they commercial considerations or other kind of considerations, someone's deciding you're doing a search for whatever it is, and they'll say, okay, you can choose among these items, and there may be thousands, but somebody is making that choice for you before you get to that point. Is that something that concerns information professionals?
Concerns us enormously. Of course, it's always been true. Publishers have decided which books they'd publish or which journals they'd publish and what they'd put in them. Libraries have decided within their limited budgets what they would buy or what they could not afford to buy. And our cataloguers have done their best to describe things in an unbiased way. But inevitably, they've put certain intellectual understandings onto the catalogue cards, the catalogue records that they've made. So there's always been some filter there. And we can only rely on the integrity of those involved. The worry now is the involvement of governments, government censorship, governments deciding that there are some things that we should not read or see, perhaps because of well-founded fears such as the current concerns about terrorism. There are concerns about commercial involvement, either suppressing information which they may see as harmful to their interests, or pushing information on us which they may see as advantageous to their interests. And that's an area I've worked in for many years, the so-called free access to information, freedom of expression, trying to negotiate our way through those issues and ensure as far as possible that systems operate in an ethical basis where what you see is what you get. Mm. The hardest thing, of course, is knowing what you haven't seen, what you've missed.
Yeah. Well, in the cause of free access to information, obviously libraries and librarians have been leading this charge for a long time, and it's a main concern of people in your field. So that's really not a new kind of an impulse for people who in the library and information field. Maybe it's more difficult now than it was before, probably both because there's so much information and that there are also these sorts of questions about, you know, who's deciding what's going to be out there. Is that somehow more, do you think now is this an even more important role for libraries to play?
I think it's a vital role because libraries should be, as I said earlier, safe spaces. They should be spaces that are unbiased. When you go into them, you should be confident that the librarians don't have another agenda. Their only agenda is to help you get information. And in the wider community, that libraries fill that role of providing unbiased access to information. And that's, of course, why the American Library Association, working together with bodies like the ACLU, have worked so hard to ensure that the First Amendment rights are respected in this country. Similar things happen in other countries, not with the same history or always with the same success as has been achieved here.
Mm. What does this mean for the education of library professionals? Does this mean that you need a whole new skill set that you might not have needed before?
I think it's now clearer that the ethical basis of librarianship really is at the front of librarianship and that the technical skills follow behind that. In the past, perhaps we tended to emphasise the skills in cataloguing, the skills in selection, the skills in what we called reference librarianship, working with the clients. Now we say that it's really important that people understand their roles first and that the skills flow from that. In the United States and in Australia, that's relatively easy because we're used to that. That's the sort of language we talk. In some other countries, that's much harder. And of course, people can face intimidation, they can face risk to their careers and sometimes to their lives.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Alex Byrne. He is the president of the International Federation of Library Associations. He's also pro-vice chancellor and vice president of teaching and learning and vice president of alumni and development at University of Technology in Sydney, Australia. And he's here visiting the campus. His visit is sponsored by the Mortenson Center for International Library Programs. He's here for the 16th annual Mortenson Distinguished Lecture, talking on this very subject that we have been talking about here this morning. Can international organizations deliver the information society? His talk is today, 4 o'clock this afternoon, at the Graduate School of Library and Information Science, room 126, and I'm expected that anyone who would be interested in attending should certainly feel welcome. Here on this program, questions are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. This is something that some of these issues we've certainly talked about before with other kinds of folks who work in your field, with the people here at the University Library and others. And I think that one of the things that we always talk about is the challenge of moving from print to electronic form. And the fact that to do that, what you do is if you have things available, if you've digitized books and you can access them that way, that's great because it means that you can have the kind of access we've talked about. If you have the computer and if you have the skills and if you have access to the internet and so forth, well, that means that you suddenly have access to all of this information. However, it has to somehow get from the print to the digital form so that you can do that. And one of the big questions is everything going to get digitized? And if we're not going to digitize everything, how do we decide what we're going to do? And then, assuming that we don't throw the books away, they're still going to be available. But then again, here someone's making a selection process. There's someone is saying that we'll digitize this stuff. Well, we'll keep the books, and if you want to come read the book, you can do that. But you know that this great new access to so much material. Yes, there is a lot of material, but there are some limitations on what anybody's ever going to be able to get at that way.
That there's some truth in that, but what we're seeing is a great drive to make digital information available, digitizing books and journals and manuscripts, paintings. Things that we've traditionally seen in the physical form, but also making available information that we've never really been able to have in the same way. And I guess a good example of that is Google Earth, where we can come from on high into our local community and even see the street that we live in and our car parked outside our house. There's three aspects to that,
of course. I think it is a little scary, actually, yes.
But it also is a very exciting way in which we can see the world in anew. So there's both the born digital and the conversion. With your question about the selection and the conversion, generally that does happen because people have some sort of reason. It's either frequently requested material, so they're simply responding to demand. And an example I can give of that is in the Australian Digital Theses program, we had to make a choice because the resources were limited of digitising older theses. We decided we would digitise those that were currently requested on demand and those that had frequently been requested in the past, on the assumption that past interest gives some indication of likely future demand, as well as working prospectively to get all the new theses in the future. Besides that, it's often done because of the intrinsic interest, an important manuscript, an important document, a lovely illuminated book. And a good example of that is the Bibliotheca Alexandrina, the great new library of Alexandria, where they have a very exciting project to digitise books relating to that great meeting place of cultures in Alexandria, and they digitise them so that you can see the image, you can see it how it originally looked or a facsimile of that, and you can see it transliterated into Arabic and translated into French and English, and you can click between them, and you're doing new things that you could never have done if you had access to the original, which of course probably would have been limited because of its fragility.
Yeah. Do you think that particularly for the kinds of materials that big research libraries like yours and ours deal in, scholarly publications, journals, and so forth, are we moving towards the point where more and more of these things have most of their existence in electronic form, and then if you want to have a copy printed, you can get one, but that's sort of a matter of on-demand kind of printing?
Absolutely. Every format finds its place. The popular magazine that you can read on the train or the bus isn't likely to end up in a digital format because it's really convenient that you can just flip through it. Similarly, I believe that the novel that you can take to bed or you can read in a plane has got a long life ahead of it. Mm-hmm. But volatile information like directories, encyclopedias, that's rapidly becoming all electronic. There are not so many print directories available anymore. They're just not worth the paper they're printed on because the electronic can be much more immediate. It can be right up to date. With the scholarly journals, we're in a process of transition, but I believe that the same's happening. The economics of scholarly journals don't stack up. Unless you charge outrageous amounts, as some of the big scholarly publishers do, it's absurd to think that you would publish a journal that goes to 500 readers or 500 libraries around the world and cover your costs. You can only do that if you have a lot of money coming out of libraries to support it. The open access movement over the last 7 years or so has started to turn that around, and we're saying that the point about scholarly communication is communication. It's not about making money. And that means we can deliver scholarly journals free of charge to anyone with internet access in the world, which for people in universities and developing countries means they have access to the latest scholarly information just as we do here in the United States or in Australia, something that has been absolutely impossible for them in the print world.
Yeah. Well, you point to something that I think that the cost of these kind of scholarly periodical journals, and there are so many of them in virtually every field in the social sciences and in the hard sciences, there are these things. And as you say, it sometimes has been a problem for libraries to have them physically there in the library because they're expensive. They also, I'm sure, take up a lot of shelf space. And I'm sure that they're increasingly, as libraries have these kinds of budget issues, they've had to ask this question, all right, which ones are we going to have and which ones are we going to say, sorry, we don't have those? If you now go to the point where essentially they're all going to be in electronic form and access that way, that will help you get your cost down. But does that also mean to the library that, in fact, then to provide access doesn't cost the library anything? And if that's so, how did the journals must have some cost they have to recoup somehow. So I'm assuming that they have to charge. If someone wants to come along and print a copy of an article, I'm guessing they're just going to say, well, all right, that'll cost you $5, $10, you know, whatever they think that they can get people to pay.
Well, my university library is highly digitized. And by going the digital route, saying that we will prefer digital journals, if some journal's available both digital and print, we won't get the print unless the print offers something that is not available in the digital. And that is still true in a few areas where particularly very high-quality images are required, but that's rapidly changing as well. What that's allowed the library to do is vastly expand the number of journals available to our students and researchers while staying within the same budget. At first, we had some resistance from researchers saying, oh, no, I really need to have that volume. That's disappeared. Mm-hmm. What they're now saying to us is, well, I really should drop down to the library at least once a week, but it's all here at my desk. I don't really have to. And that's what we've tried to sell, the libraries everywhere, the libraries where you are. It's not just a physical place. To go to the question of cost, of course there are costs. There are always costs. In the subscribe journals that we get from the commercial publishers. We pay a lot in subscription costs. We pay essentially brokerage fees to companies that bundle them together to make access easier. And we also have to operate our own interfaces, which cost us money in staff and servers and things like that. With open access journals, and my library started an electronic press, UTS ePress, and at the moment we're publishing 5 journals and a few others coming along, and these are peer-reviewed scholarly journals. We run that with about 3/4 of a staff member and a couple of servers. So there is a cost, but it's a pretty small cost. The other costs which are involved are the content costs. The writers, who are academics around the world, who had to write anyway, except they're now writing for a journal that's delivered free rather than a journal that somebody's making a lot of money on. And the editors, who also come out of the academy and did the work anyway for free or for a small honorarium. So what we've done is really change the economic basis and remove the unnecessary costs, which are the costs of supporting the lifestyles of the wealthy publishers.
So does that make it more likely that there will be more journals created? If you don't worry, if you don't have to worry about making money, or you're not interested in making money, then does that make it more feasible if you decide you want to start a publication? There's really no reason why you can't.
That's true, and that's happening, and we're seeing more journals being created. That was happening anyway. If we look at the statistics of scholarly journals, they kept growing in numbers from the turn of the 20th century through, but particularly accelerated with the expansion of higher education over the last 50 years. The check on that is quality, and you have to have high quality, otherwise you're just producing rubbish. And the high quality essentially in the academy depends on peer review. Peer review isn't perfect, but it's the best system we've got for quality. It's where two or three other people read the article, two or three specialists in the field read the article, and they say this is worth publishing or not worth publishing. And a journal that publishes a lot of articles that are not very good will be regarded as of low quality. A journal, even a very new journal that publishes high quality articles, will rapidly be well accepted, and that's can be monitored in citation rates. So it's the quality management that really ensures the viability of the system.
We have a couple of callers here. They've been patient, so let's get right to them. They're both in Urbana, and we'll start with line one right here. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Good.
It's amazing the importance of what you're doing, because in a sense, it's basically, as if we think about it, it's really the future of the way people will access information. And one of the few words that I've listened to you say, integrity, I've never heard in relationship to the internet. I mean, it's always about billions of pages and billions of this and billions of that. No validation of content. No way to for instance, you're talking about the integrity of and trust and stuff like that. So basically, you have to invert the argument to who's using the internet and are they skeptical, trained or educated to be skeptical about information they're looking at. And I'm wondering if you addressed that in your lectures.
Yes, I have. That's a very important point. Mm-hmm. The issue of trusted sources has become a much bigger question with the internet, because we can't and don't want to control the sources going into the internet. The genius of the internet, of course, is that it's such a robust system that's open to anything. But that also means that through the internet we get much information that's wrong, some that's lying, some that's dangerous. And the only way to manage that effectively in an open society is to have informed users. And that's what we now call information literacy. And so libraries which built their reputation as trusted repositories through selection, through choosing what was good information that people could rely on, now do that as to some extent by providing guidance, but they do it particularly by helping their clients develop information literacy, whether they're students in a university or elderly people coming to the internet for the first time.
Yes. Yeah, and I really don't envy you in your job, but it's actually fascinating because, as I said earlier, it seems to me like that it seems to be sort of glossed over. I mean, everybody always, as you said earlier, you know, we were talking about eliminating journals. As a matter of fact, I use extensively the internet for the intellectual sources of like Nature and things like that, you know, well-known publications, and flipped a, you know, URL to link to the other objects. It's a great resource, but I'm always wondering. Validation, and because we always had this filtering mechanism before, and I'll look around and think, a lot of people say things to me, I don't think so. But I'm glad you're addressing that. I think it's, what if not the most important issue of the whole deal. And thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Thanks for the call. Let's talk with someone else in Urbana. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in the longevity of the media that we're using with digital media. Our printed documents, except for those printed between, say, 1900 and late 1800s and the 1950s or 60s, have held up pretty well. We have a lot of documents going back to the invention of the printing press and manuscripts that are millennium older. But it looks like even our CDs may not last more than 100 years. And there's a greater problem in the software that reads them. It would seem we'd have to be constantly transferring material from one system to another.
This is certainly a major problem, something that's exercising the minds of librarians and IT specialists around the world. IFLA, the International Federation that I'm president of, has programs in this area. We have our Preservation and Conservation Network across national libraries around the world, and a number of them, including my own National Library in Australia, the Library of Congress here, National Library, the Royal Library in the Netherlands, are working on these issues. How do we not only capture and carry forward the digital information of today, but ensure its ongoing usability? And that goes beyond the media, as you quite rightly point out, to issues of software, data encryption, and so on. They're not small issues, but they're issues that we need to engage with. However, as you also pointed out, we've had a history of making some bad choices with our wood pulp acid paper and needing to recover from that. I hope that we can use that as an object lesson to not make the same errors or similar errors in the digital environment.
I guess there were a few people when the microfiche came out who did dispose of their huge newspaper libraries, but I think we learned some lessons there that we probably wouldn't do that again.
The answer there seems to be to have shared high security, in all senses of security, mm-hmm. repositories where we can keep so-called last copies and keep them under secure conditions to carry them forward. They're really intended as backup, as belt and braces, rather than for immediate use.
Complicated problem. I certainly like to hear your talk. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We have some other folks here who we'd like to get in, but I also want to introduce again the guest for anybody who might have tuned in. We're talking this morning with Dr. Alex Byrne. He is president of the International Federation of Library Associations and Institutions. It is the leading international body representing the interests of library and information services and their users. Has 1,700 members in 150 countries around the world. In addition, he serves as the pro vice chancellor and vice president of teaching and learning and... Is this, have I got all this right on its step?
You must get awfully sick of saying those long titles.
Well, I'm used to it because in higher education, we love long titles, obviously. He's Pro Vice Chancellor, Vice President of Teaching and Learning, and Vice President of Alumni and Development at the University of Technology in Sydney, Australia. And he's here visiting the campus. His visit is sponsored by the Mortenson Center for International Library Programs. And he will be giving a talk on the subject, Can International Organizations Deliver the Information Society? It's the 16th Annual Mortenson Distinguished Lecture this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Graduate School of Library and Information Science, room 126. So if you'd like to hear his talk, you should feel welcome. You're on the program, too. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll take our next caller in Terre Haute, line 4, right here. Hello.
Hello. Thank you, Dr. Byrne and David. please don't take this as a hostile question, but it's one that I'm quite concerned about, and you happen to be on the hot seat. I'd ask you and David if either of you personally know anyone who has read an entire book online or through one of these digitized forms. We regularly have reports coming out now about the decline of adult literacy. The National Endowment for the Arts recently, about a year ago, published one, and it comes out, more and more comes out every day. I'm wondering if the emphasis on information retrieval and digitization and libraries as institutions of information rather than cultural institutions play a part in this illiteracy sweeping at least the United States. Could you speak to that, please?
That's a big and multifaceted question. The first part of it about whether people have read books in full online, well, I have, and I have to say that I would find that more useful for reading for professional reasons, and that's what I've done. As I said earlier, that I think that the novel that I can read in bed or on the plane or while I'm relaxing still is very viable. The attempts to produce electronic books that are portable, while they seem to be getting stronger, haven't really been successful in replacing the casual book or the literary book that we might read. But I think you're drawing a long bow when you connect the role of libraries in providing information to growing illiteracy. Since the 19th century, the mid-19th century, the library in this country and in the UK and to other countries where similar models have spread has been seen as the poor man's university. It's long been focused on education and information.
Yes,
the change in technology, I don't think, has changed that.
I understand that. I'm not really talking about illiteracy. Of course, I'm talking about illiteracy, people that know how to read but choose not to read. Their reading seems to be fragmented, skimming, grabbing this and that, and libraries increasingly seem to cater to that kind of thing. You know, I heard the comment about limited budgets and that libraries can't afford everything. Well, I just wonder how many libraries at the community level and university level have reached the tipping point as far as supporting the what Andrew Motion calls the magical value of printed material versus the meaningful value, that is the instrumental value, and the emphasis on information retrieval to the detriment, and I would say to the funding of the library's cultural mission has reached a tipping point, but I have not seen any studies to support that, but it's just a sense of using several libraries in my community.
Well, in my role as IFLA president, I'm privileged to see libraries in many countries, and the magical value of the book and of reading certainly hasn't disappeared. I see great enthusiastic use of libraries in poor barrios in Latin America, in wealthy suburbs in Europe, and so on. Where I don't see it are in countries where there's not a strong tradition of libraries, particularly of public libraries, and that's true of many of the southern European countries and North African countries, and indeed in other parts of Africa. It seems to me, from observing these phenomena around the world and from my involvement in the World Summit on the Information Society, that the causes are elsewhere, and the causes lie in the proliferation of media and the demands of society. In Iceland, for example, which had a very strong reading culture, probably due partly to the Calvinist history and partly to the very long dark nights and inclement climate, extremely inclement climate, they are very concerned there about exactly the same thing that you're pointing to. But they see it coming from the spread of television and, more recently, computer games, and that illiteracy is a result of people spending their time in other pursuits rather than engaging in the long interrogation process that's involved in reading a book.
Of course, I wouldn't put libraries at the top of my hit list on this. I would see it as the fortress and the bastion against this kind of thing, but unfortunately, I just see more and more libraries bending in that direction, in the direction of video games, punch a button, and what's important will come up on the screen, versus go to the shelves, go through the shelves, take a book, sit down and read it, take it home. More and more I go to the library, and I have to use interlibrary loan. Yet once a month or once every 6 months, libraries shovel books out the front door and sell them for a quarter each, and I don't see them being replaced at the same speed or with the same enthusiasm of another computer and another computer whiz coming into the library, being hired at a high price, versus a librarian who's really been trained in the humanities, the social sciences, a broad background that can really help readers and move them along. They can tell them which buttons to push, but really not because they themselves have, in their training, have not been widely trained any longer in the humanities and the social sciences. They've been trained in technology. They're just not ready to give that kind of guidance. So I thank you for your remarks. I'm sorry I can't be there to hear you in person. I hope more is written on this. And David, I hope you ask all your future guests how many of them have read an entire book online.
Okay. Well, if I have the opportunity to do that, we'll do that. I have not myself. And I appreciate the comments of the caller. It seems to me that it shows that, again, I think a big challenge for libraries, particularly, I think, community public libraries, it's not that people want less. It's that people want more. I think that they want a lot of the kinds of things that the caller is talking about. You know, they want to be able to go down there and get CDs of music and DVDs and maybe video games, and they want that to be a place where they can access the internet. But it seems to me that there are still a lot of people who want books. That's what I want when I go down into the library. I want the old-fashioned kind of thing. I like the way it feels. I like the way it smells, and I like the way the pages turn. And you know, I never really quite believed that there would be a substantial market for e-books, not for pleasure reading, at least for professional stuff maybe, but I don't want to read my novels that way, and I think probably most people would say no, I don't want to read my novels that way either.
Well, if you go back to the 1950s, there are many articles talking about the wonders of microfilm and microfiche. A library in a suitcase was the slogan. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we all found that they were great for archival materials because you could store a lot in a small amount of space, you could reproduce cheaply and deliver widely, and they were fairly stable and pretty good for long-term preservation, but an absolute pain to read. And nobody reads a novel on microfilm for pleasure. You read it because you have to for your graduate study. And I think that's what happens with all media, all formats. They find their place. And I think that's what we're seeing. After all, the digital revolution is very young. It's only 25 years since the invention of the personal computer. And we can really date the digital revolution from that. In fact, as I said earlier, I think it's the World Wide Web that really made it accessible for all except information junkies like me.
Let's talk with someone else in Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to ask you about your experiences and maybe your perspective over a period of time about the being an international organization at this time of super powerful corporations and hyper-powered countries. A while back, IFLA had its international meeting in Havana, and that isn't really regarded as controversial in other parts of the world, but it was here. And I don't know whether you were there for that or whether you want to comment on that. I actually wanted to ask you about, I'm sure you must do at least a scorecard about broadband access and whether IFLA goes further and actually condemns industrial countries for not expanding access to broadband, and obviously pointing the finger back at ourselves here in the U.S., which has a miserable record in enhancing broadband, and my DSL just dropped out again.
No, I wasn't in Havana, and you're quite right. That is a particular preoccupation of the United States. It's not quite such an issue in other parts of the world. IFLA has gone to hold its annual congress in a number of countries which are not known for their freedom of expression. And we had to think hard about that. And eventually our view was that dialogue is extremely important, and it's really important to go to places where people have different perspectives to you and to be able to compare your views. Moving to your other question, over the last 4 years, nearly five now, I've been heavily involved in the World Summit on the Information Society, and I'll say more about that this afternoon. And that summit had the aim of bridging the digital divide, providing access to information and the services that can be delivered across the internet to all peoples in the world, a tall order. One of the things that I'm working on now is how do you measure that success? And I'll again say a bit about that this afternoon, looking at issues such as broadband penetration, such as literacy and information literacy, at content in national languages, publishing and so on. Complex issues, but ones that we are engaging with.
Colin, that gets your question.
Yeah,
you want to follow up?
But do you actually do anything in the way of what I was suggesting? You're talking about established. I gather you haven't reached the stage of actually, because you're saying you need a methodology to.
That's right.
To explain what.
That's right. We don't have any robust measures at this stage. We've done work through our Free Access to Information Freedom of Expression program on some of the political dimensions of restrictions on access to information, but the infrastructure ones, we're still trying to find a methodology which is sufficiently robust and multidimensional so that we don't just focus on broadband access, but also look at how useful it is it. What can people do with it?
But just offhand, as an observer, can you compare Australia and U.S. versus Korea or something? Just
Well, Korea's ahead of both Australia and the U.S. Because of their emphasis on technological development and because they are a relatively small country with a relatively high urbanized population. In both Australia and the US, this is difficult because of our widespread distribution and also the many different telcos and regulatory regimes. but that's not an excuse for rich countries.
Real quick here, we have about a minute left. If you set aside the technical issues, if you say have somebody who in some country where they like to control access to information, they want to get at your library and get some of the information that's in there, but their government doesn't want them to, is there what, if anything, could you do about it?
We protest to governments and raise these issues with some success, never overwhelming success. One of the targets has to, of course, been the companies that become complicit with those governments, as Google and Yahoo have with the Chinese government. And that goes back to your earlier question about information being stopped. The people in China don't even know what they're not getting because of what Google is blocking, and that is for us a major concern and an issue that we pursue.
Well, we will have to leave it there, but for people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, you will have the opportunity to hear more from our guest, Alex Byrne. He'll talk on the subject, Can International Organizations Deliver the Information Society? This is the 16th Annual Mortenson Distinguished Lecture, sponsored by the folks at the Mortenson Center for International Library Programs here at the University of Illinois. Alex Byrne is president of the International Federation of Library Associations and Institutions. He is also pro-vice chancellor and vice president of teaching and learning at the University of Technology in Sydney, Australia. Thank you very much.
Thanks, David.
I appreciate it.